Ladies and gentlemen, if you would just... Thank you. Thank you. Let me be the first to welcome you to the National Captain America Memorial Museum. And yes, we know it's a little cramped. I'm sure many of you already know that this is the very building in which Captain Steve Rogers and Sergeant James Barnes lived from 1941 to 1942. And no, he hasn't come by to ask for his old department back yet. My name is Dr. Pauline Wheeler, and I am the executive director of this museum, and it is my very great honor to welcome you to our annual Memorial Day event. It's a little different this year. For one thing, we don't have anyone to memorialize anymore. In all seriousness, of course, this museum learned, along with the rest of the world, last year, that Captain Steve Rogers, Captain America, had not only survived the infamous Valkyrie crash, but had in fact returned to the world stage. I am sure that in the months since then, since the Battle of New York, he has learned just what a profound and pervasive impact he had on the world. He shares that with his friend, Master Sergeant James Barnes, whose family members are the reason you're here today. So, without further ado, let me introduce the cast and crew of The Night War, an audio companion, here to perform an episode of their sensational podcast live here today, in partnership with the Museum and the Able to Help Foundation. Join me in welcoming Ms. Rose Barnes and Ms. Olivia Barnes, the stellar production team behind this amazing oral storytelling adventure, the 9th District's own Congressman, Mr. Robert Proctor, and Ms. Rebecca Proctor, whom listeners of The Night War podcast will know much better as Carrie. Please remain respectful during the performance and during the question and answer session with our special guests that will immediately follow. And so, it is my pleasure to welcome you not only to this museum on this Memorial Day, but instead, and Rose, I hope it's okay if I steal some of your thunder, but to the stone villages and dusty roads of Normandy in July 1944. You are listening to The Night War, an audio companion. For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. July 2nd. One of the reporters was a dame. There was a gaggle of them all surrounding Steve and Gabe, with me and the rest off a bit. More at a share in his smokes with Monty, and I was just looking around at the village. It is like it got frozen the minute the fighting stopped and the crowds gave up. An hour, maybe, after Dernier's last charges went off behind their line, if you can call it that, and busted their wheels, and after I dropped the last Obersturmen, Gruppenfuhrer, or whatever the fuck the crowd officer ranks are. It was after the church tower came down. I don't know if you can call this place St. George Church if it hadn't got a church anymore, or by the looks of it, any saints. And no parishioners either, except for the bodies that are still left, if you know where to look, and I do. None of ours, of course, but once you cover a man with rubble and dust, you can't tell if he's a kraut. So this woman reporter wandered over to me, and she didn't say anything at all right away, so neither did I. I hate it when I have to answer the newsman's questions. Somehow me, Bucky Barnes, who spent my whole goddamn life sweet-talking everybody I ever met, gets tongue-tied trying to come up with different ways to say, gosh, am I honored to serve, and we'll be in Berlin by the 4th of July, and all the other stuff the propaganda office tries to get us to say. Anyhow, she finally goes, it must be strange to come back to the site of such a battle, and it be so quiet. Not just quiet, I told her, frozen in time. It reminded me of an article I read back in 1940 about when Finland was fighting the Soviets, and a war correspondent ran across an entire field of corpses frozen in fighting attitudes. Bodies frozen stiff, sticking their bayonets into other frozen bodies. It was right after I got drafted, and reading that sort of thing, it sticks with you when you're about to be a soldier and there's a war on, even if it wasn't our war yet. Anyway, the dame goes, James Aldridge. I didn't know what she was talking about, so I looked over at her, and I suppose she saw the stupid in my face because she explained that the guy I was talking about is somebody she knows, and she quoted the whole thing from memory. And the part that sticks with me is, as if the men had been suddenly turned to wax, there were 2,000 or 3,000 Russians and a few Finns, all frozen in fighting attitudes. Some were locked together, their bayonets within each other's bodies. Some were frozen in half-standing positions. Some were crouching with their arms crooked, holding the hand grenades they were throwing. Some were lying with their rifles shouldered, their legs apart. It is not cold here, it's hot. I'll take it over snow and ice any fucking day. Bonfire op was a goddamn miserable time. And there isn't anybody frozen throwing a grenade. But when I look at San Giorgio Gliese, I can still see in my mind's eye where everyone is, and all the crowds. Like the moment has passed here, but in my mind it is stuck. The crowd squad by the southwest corner of the cafe is reloading their gun, and 100 yards away, Gabe is climbing over the rubble to try and spot for the mortar team, even though it means he's in the open. And I'm behind him, so if I want to shoot the crowd who's got him in his sights, I've got to shoot towards Gabe. He's got to not move, because either the crowd, who he doesn't know is there, is going to get him, or the MG team is reloading well, or I might miss and hit him. I didn't miss, but all I got to do is close my eyes, and I see it happening. How do you keep calm in the heat of battle? She asked me, with a pencil in her hand and a little notebook in the other. And I didn't know what to say, so I just said, practice. It's not the first time I was on Overwatch, and Steve's downrange, or Jim, or any of them. Somehow they trust me to have their back, and I think it's that fate that makes them do stupid fucking shit. Of course, I didn't say that to the dame exactly. My mom would kill me for talking to a lady like that. Long story short, she started asking me another question, and then Dum-Dum comes up next to me and goes, Sarge, you get her to publish your future prize-winning novel yet? And she laughed, and I didn't know quite what the joke was, but then, as it turns out, she is married to Hemingway. She got interested and tried to ask me about my writing career. Fucking Dum-Dum over here is a regular Bob Hope. And I mumbled something about keeping a diary and tried to get away. But she followed me and kept asking questions. Did you think about surrendering? Did you know how many Germans there were? What was the view from the ground, the soldier's perspective? And then I was getting so riled up at all her questions that for a second I forgot she was a dame and just snapped at her. I wasn't on the goddamn ground. And then pointed out all the buildings still standing from where I shot, however many krauts I shot. And then I asked her what the hell a dame was doing in the middle of goddamn Normandy anyhow. And she just crossed her arms and said, I want to understand the war. And I laughed a little and said, Good luck, lady. Me too. Quick as a fox, she leaned in. What do you mean? You don't know why you're here? And I said no. I understood perfectly about Hitler, etc. And that, of course, that perhaps there has never been a more just war than this one. For whatever that is worth, not much to the men dying in it. But the idea of war? No, I still have not got my walnut wrapped around that. And I have participated in it, not just asked soldiers about it after the fact. She smiled, so she can take a joke. I don't think it can be understood. In fact, all you are thinking in the middle of it, even if it is only a small part of your attention because the rest of you is preoccupied trying not to let your friends die or to die yourself, is, how is this happening? What in God's name is happening? She thought I meant it was hard to keep track of everything. No, I've got a mental map of everything, all the buildings and where everyone is and where they might go. That is the sort of thing I dream about all the time, losing track of someone, or making a mistake calculating angles and wind. And I don't know if it is just me who thinks of the battlefield that way, or if every soldier has it, at least a little. So then she thought I meant that combat is surreal. No, again, it is the most real thing anyone has ever felt. Sometimes if you were in it long enough, the surreal part comes once you are out of it. Like after Jayla, or Omaha, after Azano, After any of our missions where suddenly we found ourselves in London and watching fellas dance with their best girls or people laughing and eating dinner, like we weren't just fighting for our lives 800 miles away. No, in the middle of fighting, in the middle of me climbing up to the third floor of that house, of trying to go as fast as I could so my guys didn't have to go one more minute with my eyes off them, the past and future don't exist except to grab hold of the next brick and the next after that, and then to pick the right window, and then to try and shoot between heartbeats so you don't miss. You can't miss. And all the while thinking, I'm supposed to be home. I'm supposed to be picking up end-of-day bread on sale on my way home from work at Ma's bakery that she likes around the corner from Fort Greene Park. I'm supposed to be complaining about the Dodgers losing a series, or getting a bit of sunburn, or my pay coming late, and wondering where I ought to take out Millie King if she ever says yes. Of course, I didn't say much of that to her. We have got a lot of rules to follow about keeping up morale. It's not like I want anybody thinking I'm yellow or a gold brick or anything. But she asked me enough questions that I finally felt I could get away with one of my own. When was Hemingway going to come out with another book? And she said she didn't know. And I said, well, hell, if he is running around Europe with the rest of us, I expect that when this is all over, he will have enough to say for 10 more for whom the bell tolls. She looked a little sad and then said, you're probably right. July 3rd. Took a donation for anybody's extra charms. Nobody ever has extra. But if I show up with Betsy over my shoulder in her full scope and getup, then the regular Joes just about fall over to give me theirs. Funny to see guys get starstruck at me like they do with Steve. And normally I don't like it. But if it wrangles up a birthday present for my best pal, okay. Anyhow, I found him in the second floor of a house that's half blown to shit. But a couple of beds are still there, and there's a basement full of wine, so it's a popular spot. It was just him and Jim catnapping, and Steve with his legs hanging over the side of the bombed-out second floor, and just resting for a minute. He was even swinging his legs a little, like when we were kids and we'd stick our skinny knees through the fire escape on a hot day, just to catch a bit of breeze. Too dull and hot to do anything else. Hiya, Buck, he said when I sat down next to him and put the ammo case in his lap. And what the hell's this? And I go, happy birthday, dumb punk. And he opens up the ammo box to see about a dozen packs of charms. One of them half gone. I like a bit of candy as much as the next GI. And he laughed and grabbed one. You steal these? And I said, Stephen Grant, I never stole nothing in my entire goddamn life. And he rolled his eyes and said, tell that to Rita Hurley's parents. He handed half the roll over to me, and so we are sitting there for a while, just eating candy, like it's 1927, and we're just two kids instead of men at war. And he says, you know, my birthday is the 4th of July now. And I said, what in the hell are you talking about? And he explained that I guess when he was cavorting around in a troop full of pinup girls, some propaganda officer thought it'd be aces for Captain America to be born on Independence Day instead of July 3rd, which isn't nearly so patriotic. That's the dumbest goddamn shit I ever heard, I told him after lighting my smoke, and he just smiled a little. And then I asked him, you ever feel like it's hard to remember yourself before all this? He said, no, right away. I remember how I was before, every time I can catch my breath, or run, or jump. And I said, and kick, punch, throw yourself in front of a panzer. And he just grinned and then said, but it does feel like the last year has been every bit as long as the 25 years before it. And I said, Jesus H, do I know exactly what you mean? July 5th. Had a dream I was playing baseball like we did back in Africa before Sicily. It was Harry pitching, Lipsy at first, Skip second, and John Howe at third, and me at shortstop, of course. Glenn was catcher, and it was Adler, Pritchard, and Ernie Ball in the outfield. Every single one of them killed now, except me. It was Powell at bat. I remember because we had a World Series where every platoon in Able put up two full teams and played each other in a tournament until it was 2nd Platoon, my team, against 3rd Platoon, Sergeant Pike's. The kind of dreams I have these days, I think a part of me expected it to be the crowd set bat or something. Or maybe for me to be looking around at everybody, and suddenly it's Pritchard shot in the throat like he was in Italy. Ball blown up in his own foxhole. Lipsy shot point blank in the head like he was at Azzano. And Harry bloody and maybe holding my hand in one hand and the baseball in the other, still trying to pitch. I have had that dream before. But this time it was just all of us fellas playing baseball together before any of us saw combat or died. I wish there was a word for when grief and fondness and longing get so mixed up together, you can't tell them apart. July 7th. Command got the idea to do a bit of infill and see what intelligence we can grab. Now I know OSS SSR has to be losing their collective goddamn mind that we are still here in Normandy, and also under the command of the regular army. And until now, I was fine with it, as we have done good work here. And once there comes to be actionable intel on Hydra, I am sure we will be recalled. But 7 men for a detonite op, just to try and get our mitts on a crowd officer? Never mind we don't know which one, or what he looks like. On the off chance, he might have a map that says, "Whatever you do, don't let the Americans see the secret path to ending the war tomorrow." Jesus, Mary and goddamn Joseph. July 8th. Not every officer is a dope, I guess. Op called off. Steve thinks we are getting pulled back to England soon. Frankly, I will not mind a bit of rest. July 10th. Got my hands on a bottle of cognac. Rangers really know how to find the good stuff. And went and kidnapped Jim and Dum Dum from a training exercise. Cap's orders. And we went and sat ourselves in some cafe chairs on a bombed-out street, poured out a couple of glasses for dead pals, and talked about Sicily. It has been an entire year. Who would have ever thought the war would still be going on? I remember fellows the few days before the landing talking about how in the Great War, it only took a couple of months for the doughboys to end things once we got over there. And surely this one could not be much different. We spanked the Germans once, we can do it again. Of course, Jim was not infantry then, he was doing mechanic work. He can take apart and put together anything, and wasn't schooled to become an engineer. That is my guess as to why they did not put him in a segregated unit after all. But he still had a devil of a time. He was working on a disabled tank with some pals when it moved a little and hit a mine that I guess had gotten missed. Two of his guys blown to smithereens by the tank shrapnel, and this after the fighting was supposed to be done on his beach. Dum Dum was seaborne. What a god-awful day that was. It was almost easier to count the men who were not seasick than the ones who were. By Dum Dum's account, he was at Licata. The seasickness plus anticipation was almost worse than the fighting itself. They captured their objective on the 10th, unlike us at Jela. Of course, I think that if any of us in our little platoon is a born soldier, it is Dum Dum. He laughs more in the middle of combat than he does hustling Tommies at billiards 3 sheets to the wind. Thinking of Jela does give me a little sympathy, but not that much, for the crowds, now that they are fighting a war where the only birds in the sky are American. Just about every guy I knew, me included, was cursing out the Air Forces for not doing anything to help us. Meanwhile, we were getting killed by the Luftwaffe. I remember Castellano in my face yelling, "Whatever fucking happened to a goddamn bomber an hour?" Right after another Stuka strafed us, not even 20 yards away, and Harry yelling, "Bombers are expensive, Frank. You aren't." July 13th. Mail. First mail since the invasion. Letters from everyone except Teddy. Even Jack wrote a postcard with a picture of the Hollywood sign on it, dated June 6th, though it was very short. Bucky and Steve, give them hell. Me and my pals all crowded around the radio waiting for reports, taking bets as to when we'll finally hear London calling, or perhaps, and even better, Berlin calling. Show the krauts how it's done. All my love, your favorite brother, Jack, Lance Corporal. Lovely Jack. I could just see Jack saying all that with his crooked smile and uncombed hair, and probably a black eye and a new chipped tooth, bouncing up on his heels like he used to as a kid. When he'd get so excited about something, it was like his body wasn't enough to hold it all. I guess he's writing from California, and no mention in Ma's letters about a ship date means he isn't shipping soon. One can only hope the Marines will decide he's better off pitching for the Dodgers, maybe. Also letters from Ma and Curly. Curly put about half a sentence about being top of her class again, and she wrote about getting placed for a science high school, but didn't say which one. A few months ago, I wrote her saying all the places I imagined she was writing her letters to me from, our fire escape, or the zoo, or the roof of her friend Olive Dempsey's building with the great view of Brooklyn Bridge, or somewhere else, I forgot. Anyhow, she wrote to me in this letter.
Now I know you're trying to get me feeling sorry for you, as if Bucky Barnes ever forgot a thing in his entire life.
And she's taken to going all over Brooklyn to write me letters. One from the steps at the Brooklyn Museum, and then another from the top of the arch at Grand Army Plaza. She wrote it just a couple minutes later, she said. Where she said,
I am sure that one day, when you win the war, they will have a parade for you and Steve, and you will march straight under the Soldiers and Sailors Arch with all your medals.
Seems to me she is spending too much of her time reading the papers and listening to the radio, and possibly sneaking into the pictures just for the newsreels. I wish she could find a way to just be a little girl instead of worrying about all this. I am awful afraid me or Steve will finally get our number called, and some ace reporter will wire the news home before the Army even gets a chance to tell our family properly. Not that I guess there's any real proper way to tell somebody their son got killed. I can't imagine the news coming from a guy in a uniform helps at all. But hearing about it on the radio has got to be worse. July 16th. Moving out to Vieville-sur-Orne. It's late now, but I guess Monty, the general, not ours, has been whinging, how our Monty calls it, to Ike about just the Americans getting the commandos on the front, even though he's in command of Overlord. Well, I guess it worked, because we are going in to put the fear of God into the crowds there, who are putting up a real good fight against the British infantry near Caen. This feels like another cheap stunt to me, as they are making us leave our 1st Division pals behind, even though we train with them for weeks and weeks before D-Day, and have been in battle alongside them ever since. It is grade A bullshit. We are just 7 men, and Gabe's still with a limp too, and having good trained men that we can rely on is essential if we're going to be any use as regular infantry. Steve tried to argue the same but got overruled, and he is fired up as hell about it. On short notice, we gave our best to Lieutenant Woodbridge and Massey, and as many as we could find, but the orders came in and we only had about an hour to get ourselves in order before moving out. It is bad juju to abandon your men in the middle of a campaign. None of us happy about it at all. July 27th. We were right about the bad juju. Back in London, all alive but banged up. We all thought Jim in a very bad way, but it looks like he will be okay. Dum Dum and Monty both WIA pretty bad, but should recover. Gabe okay too. Dernier with a hard knock to the head. Doctors say he is badly concussed, and we all joke that it's hard to tell the difference between regular Dernier and concussed Dernier. Of course, this is not at all true, as he can hardly stay awake and is very ill. This is what you get for thinking Captain fucking America is an infantry battalion all on his own. Steve okay, naturally in the best condition of us all. And I will not be winning any foot races anytime soon, but we are all at least alive. A sorrier lot you never did see. All the famous howling commandos laid up like a bunch of fucking grunts straight from the trenches. I lost enough blood that I blacked out in transport and woke up in the hospital with them working on me. And gave the doctor and nurses a real scare, as I did not know where I was at all, except in a fucking operating theater. Steve told me later, looking like he had aged about 50 years, mine, that the doctor foobarred my anesthetic and felt awful about it. Sorry, but I think I got the worst end of it, pal. Christ, I haven't been able to sleep since. Leg hurts all over like they're still cutting into it, and they have me in a room alone instead of a ward. I guess either because I am a real VIP, or that I keep waking up yelling. Fuck's sake, the last thing I need is a quack coming around asking me about my goddamn feelings. July 29th. Thank God for the best friend anybody ever had. Steve busted me out of the clink. This makes the second time. The sappy bastard tried to carry me like I was his fainting dame. I said no dice, pal, and hopped along as best I could until we made it outside. And there was Gabe with a truck waiting like he was my own personal Red Ball Express. And now we are back at Grosvenor Street, where we haven't been since April. And I am dead tired, or as Powell would say, rode hard and put away wet. Lord, I could sleep for a goddamn year. July 30th. Woke up to Gabe reading Frankenstein aloud in our old room. Don't know how it is, but I think a part of me must hear him talking when I'm asleep, because I wake up knowing I'm not alone. I wonder if Steve told him it was one of my favorites, or if it's just more evidence that Gabe is a real psychic. I remember me and Steve reading Frankenstein as kids, and I used to pick out scenes for him to draw, and he'd get prickly when I told him to make the monster taller or hairier, or Dr. Frankenstein look more like Sister Callaghan. As a joke, is what we told Mrs. Rogers later. She wasn't fooled. And he used to snap, "Hey, who's the artist here?" Anyhow, I guess as kids we had no idea yet our accumulation of anguish would turn out to be like this. It seems to me anguish is one of those words that you get to define over and over as you go through life.
Rose, what a performance. Thank you so much. And now, because I know we're hoping to get some of these questions into the live stream episode, and I believe you have a time limit, isn't that right?
Yes, we try to keep episodes to about 35 minutes. And let me just say, what a great audience. Thank you so much for coming out and supporting this great cause. It really means a lot to me and everyone.
Absolutely, yes. This event is jointly sponsored by the Able to Help Foundation, and as a reminder, 100% of all ticket proceeds from this event are going to that wonderful charity. So please, a round of applause for all of you. Wonderful. I've got a selection of audience questions here, and I hope we get to all of them. But first, I've got to get in one of my own for the most important person on the stage, Ms. Olivia Barnes. My question is simple. What has this experience been like for you, seeing your pet project take on such a life of its own?
Oh my God, it's been crazy. I was supposed to do this for like a high school extra credit, and here we are.
And now?
All the letters we get are like amazingly awesome and stuff, especially ones from people who are currently serving in Afghanistan. But honestly, the best part was like, I was at a school debate thingamajigger, and this guy came up to me being like, "Is it true you're making the Night War podcast?" And I was like, "Hey, yeah, that's me." And he was all, "Oh my God, are you going to have Bucky on the show?" Yeah, eye roll. Sorry to break it to you, guy. Yeah, he didn't have any idea that, you know. Number one, it is a book already and kind of famous, and we weren't just making it up for his pleasure or something like that. And, you know, number two, we all know the ending.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I had to break that news. It was not fun. It was not one of my better memories of high school.
What would you say is your favorite element of the podcast, or what you're most proud of, aside from the fact it's probably given you a heck of an admissions essay, I bet?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it. There's, like, a moratorium on college talk in my family. Mom started collecting brochures when I was 12. So, let's not. But music choices. Amazing. Because, no offense, Mom, but that's all me.
Okay, now for our first audience question. Go ahead and step up to the microphone. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. First of all, as a history major, this podcast has basically single-handedly gotten my parents off my back for choosing the major I did. So thank you. My question is for Rebecca. Ms. Proctor, what can you tell us about your brother, Jack? What was he really like?
Oh, Lord. Well, the truth is, as I see it anyway, is that Jack was a real pain in the ass. Oh, no, I'm serious. pushy and funny and competitive as all get out. And of course, I can't possibly back down from a bet. So he used to get me to agree to all kinds of made-up games where he'd fix the rules against me, and I was too damn stubborn not to shake on them anyway. He was a real snot. Older brothers can be really awful.
Yeah, mine makes me look really bad.
So did you two not get along at all? Sometimes we did. He was a lot of fun, just like Bucky. I got a lot closer with him right before he signed up. I suppose by default, since we were the only ones left at home. It was harder when he shipped out. He wasn't a great letter writer. On a few occasions, he just sent me back my own letters with his answers to my questions written in. Yes, he's still in California. No, he hasn't met any movie stars. Yes, he's still going to Japan the first chance he gets. That kind of thing. My God, was he excited to go to war? He was a lot different than Bucky, as we just heard. Bucky had never been terribly excited about the prospect. Jack thought he'd win it all himself, just for the fun of it.
And there's that whole thing where the army tried to stop him from going, right, Mom?
Oh, yes. He was stateside for months and months. The army was very worried. Well, they were very worried about something happening to all of them. And the blow to national morale, that would be... They didn't care as much about our morale, I suppose. Otherwise, they'd have answered my letters. I sent about 100 variations of, please send Bucky Barnes and Teddy Barnes and Steve Rogers home immediately. Thank you sincerely, Rebecca Barnes. Anyway, he finally did get his way. After fighting every bureaucratic battle in the world. And, well, poor, dear, terrible, awful Jack. He was killed in Okinawa just a few months after he shipped. One of the young men this day honors. Yes, he is. Okay, and let's go ahead with our next question.
Hey, and thank you so much for putting on this event. I love this podcast, and I've listened to every episode like a billion times. This question that I have is kind of relevant to what we just heard, but I was wondering, like, what was Bucky's favorite book? And do you think that he wanted to be a writer?
That's two questions, but we'll allow it. Liv, it looks as though you've got some thoughts there.
Ooh, pick me. Yes, hi.
I'm not, like, an expert on Bucky Barnes or anything, obviously, but I just, you know, wanted to say that the first time that I ever read the whole book, not for just, like, school credit, I definitely came away thinking, like, this guy, he wanted to be a writer, because nobody who doesn't talks about Hemingway that much.
Good point. Rebecca, what do you think? Truthfully, I'm not sure what his favorite books were. I think there's a young man running around in red, white, and blue who'd be more qualified to answer that. I was a little girl, you understand. So most of the time, the books and stories he talked to me about were the ones he thought I'd like. I fell in love with A Little Princess when I was 10 or so, and he spent about a month convincing me it was his favorite, too.
What did he do to convince you?
I'd taken to trying to sleep on our fire escape, pretending it was a garret, just like Sarah had, naturally, and he pretended to be Ramdas and used to sneak me blankets and cookies.
That's adorable. Do you think he wanted to be a writer?
Oh, I do. He was always writing stories and little poems and things. He didn't talk very much about it, and he used to get so embarrassed if you asked him. But he was a lot like our mother in that way. She wrote about 1,000 poems she never let anyone read.
Rose is giving me some significant looks here, so let's just try and close out this event with two more questions. Up in the front, please.
This is a question for Curly and the Congressman. Basically, I want to know what the family thinks about the fact that Cat has supposedly come back and everybody talks about him as his big hero, even though Bucky was the real hero. And Cap is just propaganda for the military industrial.
Okay, home. Not one of the approved questions. I apologize for that.
Oh, wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
Excuse me? Hold on there, Gooseman. Cap's supposedly come back? Like, is this up for debate now? What?
No, what really happened on that train? Cap was
oh,
the only
please.
One there.
Oh, my goodness. Rose, honey, is this ruining your show? Not at all, Auntie.
Well, I have a thing or two to say.
Yeah, well, you know what? I have at least three things to say to you. So, boom, Rex!
I've seen this in the papers. There are people who are angry about Steve helping out New York a year or so ago. Isn't that
There's
right?
There's really no need,
Ms. Proctor. I'd offer to shut down some of these conspiracy theories, but somehow
also,
I don't think that would
aliens,
help.
Like, what does that have to do with the military-industrial complex?
Well, all I have to say is this. Steve is back. I don't doubt it at all. And the family is very glad indeed that he is. Even if he is an awful big dope sometimes. Just in case he is listening, I say this. Stephen Grant Rogers, I cannot believe you went and saw Teddy before me. I am rescinding my offer of marriage right this minute.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, okay, let's just try and get one more question in. I think I'll take this one. It was from an online submission, and it's for Congressman Proctor. I have it on good authority. His family calls him Robbie.
Yeah. My friends call me that, too, which I assume everyone in this room is.
And voters. Very well, Robbie. This question relates back to the D-Day episode and how strange it was to hear FDR praying publicly, when today that's a very uncommon thing to see politicians doing.
In blue states, at least.
Of course. Well, this question is, as a veteran and a politician, what is it like seeing that gap between lived experience as a soldier and the way that experience is thought of and spoken of by politicians?
That is a great question. In my experience, the big picture is the furthest thing on your mind in combat. I served in Desert Storm, a conflict that lasted about 6 weeks. It didn't take us very long to figure out what Bucky was talking about. We weren't thinking about what politicians were saying on the radio or what was on CNN or anything like that.
Yes, that first 24-hour news coverage.
Yeah. And just like him, we were focused on the mission and on our friends. And Bucky talks about that a lot. Especially in the section that we just listened to. I'm paraphrasing, but specifically, when he says the only thought that you have room for, besides not letting your friends die or dying yourself, is, how is this happening? So yeah, that's what stuck with me the most. And in fact, I have an index card in my office to remind myself of that quote, that that politicians can start wars, but soldiers fight them.
An important message to hear, especially on Memorial Day. Thank you, Congressman. And thank you very much, Ms. Proctor, Rose, Olivia, for this wonderful live performance and sharing your stories with us today. It's been a very special Memorial Day event. Okay, a quick logistical reminder. Additional Q&A time is planned in the museum lobby beginning in about half an hour, as well as meet and greet opportunities, not just with our esteemed guest, but with the Executive Director of the Able to Help Foundation. Thank you all for coming to this special presentation. It's been an honor for the museum to host, and we hope to see you all again soon. Thank you.